Sure is. With our special guest tonight, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe. And we'll continue with this incredible story of this large disc that was removed by a military truck. Back with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Here's Linda now with part three of this incredible story that happened a long time ago. It's hard to believe how long ago this was, Linda.
Right. March 25th, 1948. And look how good our counterintelligence is in the United States. All of this has been going on, and they have tried to make everybody think that everything is weather balloons and swamp gas and somebody selling oil and gas leases, while in fact, underneath all of this is military communication. And Bill Steinman describes in his 1986 book in detail how military and government authorities were alerted about the Hart Canyon disk. On page 45, Bill Steinman says, quote, a telex was sent to headquarters, Assistant Chief of Staff, G2 Army Intelligence in Washington, D.C., from Camp Hale, Colorado, describing the craft and the recovery operation. A copy was transmitted to Counterintelligence Special Headquarters at Pope Air Force Base within the Fort Bragg complex in North Carolina. Captain Virgil Poskowaite with the Counterintelligence V Corps, along with his Air Force counterpart, handled a telex, which is the following. Quote, flying object of unknown origin recovered near Aztec, New Mexico. Craft approximately 100 feet diameter, 30 feet height. One window port blown. Bodies on board. All occupants dead, 4 feet height. Oversized heads. Craft has metallic skin, thin as newspaper, but too tough to penetrate by conventional tools. Private property was purchased from locals in order to facilitate transporting the craft to base, close quote. Dr. Vannevar Bush of MJ-12 fame ordered preservation containers for the alien bodies at the Office of Scientific Research and Development in Washington, D.C., and he was part of the MJ-12 effort to study, and they wanted to back engineer extraterrestrial biological entity technology, but they were all carrying out the President Harry S. Truman policy of denial in the interests of national security, where it was huge penalties if anybody with a need to know on any of these operations with non-humans and non-terrestrial craft, they would really, really get in serious trouble, and so would their families. Also, at the center of highly secret and classified UFO analysis and back engineering efforts was Eric Henry Wang, Ph.D. Dr. Wang had a friend named Nicholas von Papen, a photographer who specialized in metallurgical close-up photography for aerospace. In November of 1949, this is later now in the, about a year and a half later, Dr. Wang asked von Papen to help photograph a highly sensitive subject in New Mexico. Von Papen was flown to Los Alamos to photograph what Steinman says was the Aztec disc. Bill Steinman reported, quote, from there they boarded a bus with black out windows, which they took to a top secret location within the Los Alamos complex. Von Papen was amazed at what he saw, a huge disc-shaped object of a shiny brushed aluminum finish sitting on the ground with military brass, intelligence guards and officers and scientific personnel all around it. Von Papen described the ship as some sort of computerized, electromagnetically driven flying saucer, close quote. Well, if the big Aztec disc ended up at Los Alamos, how did they get that big craft out of Hart Canyon? Did it go anywhere else first? And which military branch retrieved the disc and the bodies? Here now, again, is Scott Ramsey.
When you say military, what branch and what seemed to be the reason that they showed up?
That's the most intriguing thing. Doug Nolan said there was no insignia, such as Air Force, Army, Navy, anything. They were older men. They came by vehicles, what Doug called deuce and a quarters, which are the old troop carrier, the trucks. The whole top of the mesa, including Mr. and Mrs. Knight, were all separated. So they were completely separated and interrogated. And it was in a very, very threatening manner, and they were told to get out.
So the oil field workers who were up on the craft, the helicopter had flown over and seen them there. When the military showed up, someone, without showing any rank or what branch, ends up threatening the oil and gas field workers.
Yep. You're dealing with 19 and 20-year-old kids that, as both Ken and Doug told me, we had a lot of respect for the military. Hell, we're just coming off winning World War II. But then again, we are young kids, and we don't take kindly to people bossing us around when it's a one-way street. They're not telling us who they are. They're wanting to know everything about us, and we're telling them, we don't have to answer you. We're not in the military. We're civilians. And Ken said that didn't go over too well because he got a rifle stock into his gut.
And with that rifle stock in his gut, what were these military intimidators saying?
You ready to listen and behave now? Because we're going to try to talk to you one more time. He said they weren't messing around, and they seemed extremely upset that anybody was at the crash site.
This appeared to be some kind of a military operation in which they did not want to be identified.
That's exactly right. The craft came down at 5 o'clock in the morning. And one person we haven't talked about, Valentine Archuleta, who's referred to in Steinman's book as VA. Valentine Archuleta claimed he called the military at about 4:45 in the morning. He's a farmer. He claimed at about 4:45, while coming out to tend to his goats and sheep, he saw a huge disc come over his ranch and actually hit the mesa behind his house. That's well talked about in Steinman's book.
Right.
Valentine Archuleta, one of the few people in that area that had a phone back then, ran in and called Kirkland and said, these flying discs that you're talking about, these flying saucers, one just about crashed in my ranch. It hit a mesa behind my house.
And that would have been the first call that somebody in power who might have been plugged in would know something had happened?
And we have to add the possibility that Manuel Sandoval, the Cuba police officer, claimed he had been following it all night.
Right.
We don't know the altitude, but knowing that terrain, there's a good feasibility that somebody picked it up on radar. Manuel Sandoval had told his friends that thing had been causing havoc at Los Alamos. You know, he patrolled between Los Alamos and White Horse Canyon. He patrolled the pipeline, as we talked about earlier.
And havoc at Los Alamos would mean that this large disc in the sky that he was tracking from his police car was doing something focused on Los Alamos?
Yes. This UFO had been seen up at Los Alamos nights before. I think that if that object had been around that long all night for Manuel Sandoval to track it, There's a good chance one of the radar installations, especially Alvado, which back then was Los Alamos, would have picked it up and they would have had a radar lock on it. Flying saucers had been seen in the area prior to the one that came down March 25th, 1948.
If that occurred at 5 a.m. in Hart Canyon, then for the military to get from Kirtland, if that was the source, whatever this team was that did not have identification and have uniforms with names, then those 5 to 6 hours that it would have taken to go on the roads in 1948 would explain why they did not show up in those trucks before 11 a.m. to noon.
Yeah, I agree, Linda, but that would still be a tough task. Could the Air Force have had people staged in and around New Mexico in the Four Corners area or somewhere in between Los Alamos and a point A to point B to either photograph, shoot down, whatever, these objects violating restricted airspace?
And they might even have been based at Alvado.
That would have been about the only point of getting from an installation to the mesa in that time frame.
how at noonish midday on March 25th, 1948, could a military operation get something large on a large truck out of Hart Canyon near Aztec without everybody knowing?
They didn't. The recovery, the best of our research, took 2 weeks. 2 weeks from the time it came down to the time Hart Canyon was opened back up for the ranchers to get back in there.
Well, then how did they close it out from people who wanted to see what happened?
It would be just as easy back then as it would be today. If they closed it, you and I would never know, would we?
Well, did anybody testify that they saw tape or saw horses or something that blocked the canyon?
I have a testimony from a girl, and on that day, she and her older sister decided to go horseback riding and go out Hart Canyon Road. However, about halfway out, they were stopped by some nice guys in a military Jeep. The men said, "You can't go out here. This road's closed." They didn't ask why. And they said, "Well, how long is it going to be closed for?" And they said, "Oh, quite a while. They're doing some work up here, and it's not safe, especially on your horses." Did that have anything to do with the UFO crash? We don't know. But what are the chances of two guys in a Jeep blocking Hart Canyon Road?
Right. And what was the population of Aztec in March of 1948?
1,800, 2,200, something like that.
Have you ever interviewed anyone who had firsthand knowledge or speculated about why there would have been that crack in the porthole?
50 caliber artillery shell would be about that size. I don't know if, you know, that's really going out on a limb. No proof that there was a 50 caliber machine gun or dual 50 anti-aircraft guns in that area. We know Los Alamos had asked for them, but we don't see in any of the correspondence that they got any.
Okay, has anyone that you have talked to had firsthand information about where the 99-foot disc went for study?
All fingers start pointing due east to Los Alamos.
How would they have gotten it into Los Alamos without the media and everybody catching on?
Well, back in 1948, you were just 3 years after World War II, Los Alamos was still very, very off the radar screen, so to speak. Now, the American public was well aware that it existed, unlike prior to the end of World War II, when nobody really knew. I mean, the people that worked there, their birth certificates don't even show they were born in Los Alamos. They show they were born in Santa Fe.
Wow.
They all had a P.O. box in Santa Fe. It's the same one. I think it's P.O. box 600, if my memory's right.
Trying to keep it all covered up.
Right. That was the old boys' club. Well, now if you've got a pristine piece, I don't think back then you'd want to take it to Wright-Patterson. I don't think you'd want to take it to Kirtland, because who at Kirtland's going to do anything with it?
Right.
So in my opinion, looking at what was going on in the time frame, I'd want to take it where 10,000 really, really smart people work, and that would be Los Alamos.
Would they have any place big enough to store this 99-foot diameter disc for scientists to study?
I mean, I believe that there was a building Y-22, which was plenty big to house it.
Why do you think that the Aztec Hart Canyon crash was so sensitive?
Look at the research that's been done on Roswell over the years. One thing we do all agree on is the military blew it by putting that press release out that a flying disc was recovered. That has come back to haunt them for 60-some years. 68 years are we at now? With Aztec, I think they learned. I think after Roswell, the military said, okay, we know these flying discs are coming over very restricted airspace, very sensitive areas. New Mexico back then in 48 still is today the hotbed of military R&D. I mean, look at 47. By now, we've got most all the V-2 rockets unloaded at Carrizozo and shipped down to White Sands. We've got the experimental radar bases going up. The P-80 jet. March Air Force Base in California had them. New Mexico had them. You had so much going on. You had Sandia National Labs. You had Los Alamos. New Mexico was the hot spot of military activity. There had to be a way after Roswell for the government to say, this can't happen again. We know we're going to shoot one of these things down. If they keep coming into our airspace, it's inevitable. And when we do, we need a means to go in and recover these quickly and quietly and find out what the hell they are and who the hell they belong to.
Right.
Are they Soviet? Are they German? Are they extraterrestrial? What are they?
Well, by then, I think there's no question, based on other documents concerning Truman and MJ-12, they already were categorizing them as extraterrestrial biological entities.
Right.
And, George, there is an insight about how they got that big 99.9-foot disc apart. And it is on page 40 in Bill Steinman's UFO crash at Aztec that came out in 1986.
With pretty good detail, too, isn't there?
Well, this is tremendous detail in this book. And he says the scientists that were brought in at the site first tried cutting torches without success. Remember, Twick said that it was as thin as newspaper, but so strong they couldn't cut through it. The torches didn't even phase the metal, which had a brushed aluminum-type appearance. Then they tried diamond drills and diamond cutting saws. One bit and blade after another dulled very quickly. The material just could not penetrate. Finally, one scientist, after a very thorough examination, found a place on the inside where there was some sort of interlocking key device. When he pulled on the device, a seam opened up on the ship at that particular location from top to bottom, like it went into sections. He continued around the ship and found several of these devices at equally spaced intervals. Here was the key to the disassembly problem they had been looking for. They couldn't use brute force, heat, or diamond drills, but the craft itself had some kind of mechanism in which it would come apart in sections, and that's how, after 2 weeks or so later, they finally started moving out this big craft in sections. And the issue is, did they go straight to Los Alamos, and is that where it was, perhaps in a building in what they called the Y section in Los Alamos? And there have been lots of rumors about, like, building Y-22 might have been where the Aztec craft and maybe others went. And I personally hope that everybody listening to Coast, if you have any other firsthand information about this extraordinary Aztec crash or any insights from being inside of military or intelligence, you can talk with me off the record or on the record, with or without names, at earthfiles@earthfiles.com.
All right. And next hour, Linda is going deep into space, and we're going to cover a story that could be a black hole eating up a star system. Well, check in with Linda. Then the final hour, of course, will be conversations with Linda, your questions, and also that's how she gets many of her stories from those of you who call in. Some of you are whistleblowers for the government, and you just want us to know what is happening. We'll take those calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. So we'll be right back. Don't touch your dial. Linda, next hour, I want to talk with you as we take phone calls with you about the FBI vault and something about cattle mutilations.
Right.
That's another great story. But you've got something going on about a cosmic explosion.
And scientists are calling it unprecedented. Our cosmos is constantly coming up with mysteries, and this is really something. Since the Big Bang, 13.7 billion light years across and ago, the most powerful explosions in this universe are huge flashes of what are called gamma ray bursts, or GRBs. They are extremely rare and fleeting. The sources of gamma ray bursts are usually billions of light years from Earth outside our Milky Way. Their gamma intensity is so great that if there were a GRB in our galaxy pointed directly toward Earth, I'm not kidding, it would cause mass extinction. So far, scientists do not know what causes them. Are they black holes tearing massive stars apart, or two neutron stars colliding, or something even more exotic? GRBs were first detected in 1967 by the Vela satellites that looked for covert nuclear weapons tests. The strange gamma intensities were confusing and mysterious until 1997, not very long ago, when the first X-ray and light glows were imaged and their redshifts were measured with optical spectroscopy. After a decade of research, scientists now hypothesize that a GRB is a narrow beam that bursts outward at near the speed of light from the supernova of maybe a large star that is collapsing into either a neutron star or maybe even into a black hole. And then in November 2004, NASA and the European Space Agency launched the Swift Gamma Ray Burst Mission to study cosmic GRBs in wave bands that vary from gamma rays to X-rays to ultraviolet and to optical. And by April 13, 2010, a year ago, SWIFT had already detected its 500th gamma ray burst, these mysterious objects that are still not understood. And about a year later, on March 28, 2011, just about a month ago, SWIFT picked up an unusually long, powerful gamma burst coming from the center of a galaxy 3.8 billion light years from Earth. But instead of fading away, the object oscillated intense energy. First, it did three times over more than a day. And it is still continuing to emit at a lower but pretty constant level. Since April 3rd, the variable object has even brightened by more than five times. No one knows what this is. Astronomer Andrew Fruchter, PhD at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, was involved in getting the Hubble telescope's image of this mysterious blast combined with the Chandra X-ray Observatory's image to confirm that, in fact, the intense energy is persisting from the very center of this distant galaxy. Recently, I asked Dr. Fruchter what the current ideas are about what the baffling object could be. And he begins with the possibility that the unprecedented and lingering gamma blast might be a peculiar form of something called a blazar. A few blazars have been associated with violent eruptions from supermassive black holes at the center of giant elliptical galaxies, but so far, blazar is only speculation about the baffling and energetic object nearly 4 billion light years from Earth. And remember, whenever this unprecedented energy exploded, the Earth and this solar system were just forming. Here now is Dr. Andrew Fruchter.
SWIFT had never seen another object outside of our galaxy appear to act this way. And it's quite unlike anything we know of before. Things called blazars, when you're looking right down that relativistic jet, it's pointing right at you, and it's like you're staring into a headlight. They behave very much like this object, except they don't vary as quickly as this object does.
Yeah, I was hoping you could talk about why. I know that you were quoted in one of the Science News articles as saying it's either a phenomenon we have never seen before or a familiar event that we've never viewed in this way before. What is it that makes this so unique?
SWIFT has seen blazars before, but in fact, they've never found one on their own. And they never vary this quickly. The fastest it does things is a couple of minutes. So for us, that's pretty fast.
Right, because you're talking about that at least the speculation is that a star might be being torn apart,
or
there is an orbit around a massive black hole. So how could anything go around the black hole every 100 seconds?
Right, yeah, exactly.
And since the human mind cannot comprehend a gigantic, massive black hole that would have something orbiting around it in 100 or 200 seconds, is there any other speculation about what this enormous variable energy could be?
I would say that people are not fully convinced that it is a star being torn up by a massive black hole. And here, this may be the first of a new type of object. And so we may have guessed it right, or we may have it completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But people have been thinking that we should see a star destroyed by a massive black hole.
And is there a name for this galaxy?
No. There are billions of galaxies, and so they just don't have names. The object has a name. Originally, it was GRB. Now it's SW in front, and then its coordinates on the sky. It is a gamma ray burst, but in the sense that we now think gamma ray bursts are generally a specific phenomenon.
And they only last about 30 seconds.
Yes, exactly. There are some that have lasted longer, but they don't come back and be just as powerful. They slowly die down, and occasionally a little bit comes up again. But this has been, you know, quite extraordinary.
And we're talking on April 21st, which means that this object has been present to you and you've been collecting data for at least 25 days.
Right. And what was unusual about this is particularly is that it has largely leveled off. And it has leveled off. It's continuing to emit at a lower level, but at a pretty constant level. We thought for a while it was going to go away, and then it just came back up. So I don't know. We just don't know what to expect. It might be something that we've seen before, but we're seeing it in a different way and just don't realize it. But no one's been able to think of what that is. So it looks like it is something new, and the suggestion is that it is a star being torn apart by a black hole.
But still might be something else completely different.
It still might be. We don't have any observation that is conclusive.
Well, when I look at the photograph that you have so far released, I was struck by how many, I'm going to call them, spikes of light seem to be coming off the object.
Yeah, that's right. This may be the first time we've seen a star torn apart by a black hole.
When we say that you are trying to figure out what is happening 3.8 billion light years from here, this is an event that took place 3.8 billion light years ago in Earth time.
Right, so it was about the time that the Earth was forming. Shortly after the Earth formed, this is when this all happened.
And we're just seeing it for the very first time right now.
That's right.
Is it possible that we could be seeing a white hole from another universe?
I haven't heard anyone suggest that. But I don't know anyone who's, you know, late said, okay, if an astronomer were looking out and ran into a white hole, here's what they would see. You know, then maybe this would have to be one just forming. I don't know.
In cosmology, there are literally millions of black holes in this universe, correct?
Oh, yes, yes.
If there are millions of black holes in this universe, theoretically, isn't there that question that those black holes, that energy from the black holes might be erupting someplace else in white holes?
That is something that's speculated about. That is a part of, that's a part of relativity that's not well understood. And whether white holes really exist or not, whether white holes should really exist or not is something that is not well understood.
Hmm.
It's a possibility, but whether you actually can make them, I have asked relativists and I've never gotten a clear answer. Is that you have material actually, from our point of view, material takes forever to fall into a black hole because what happens when you fall into a black hole is that you become redshifted. It looks like your time goes slower and slower and slower to the outside world. To you, you just fall straight in. But to the outside world, it looks like you're going very, very slowly as you fall in. And you never quite reach that time, that horizon event. So if the material, in our point of view, never gets in there, how does it ever get out in a time scale? So it may be that white holes could sort of be there, but the material can never get out. Something that is still not well understood, and I think may not be understood until we really are able to combine quantum mechanics and relativity, which is where we expect, this is related to Hawking radiation and black hole evaporation. I mean, it may really take that sort of understanding at a deep level to really solve these sort of things.
So if this object does continue in this intense energy that's oscillating, let's say for a year or two, and you all are continuing to study, theoretically it's possible that this would be the tearing apart of a star at the rim of a black hole and that it would take forever for this to occur.
Well, but then it gets less and less energetic as it falls in. So I don't know that if it's going on in a year or two from now, I don't know that a star will work. I don't know if that, if the question will then be, could that, why hasn't the star been completely ripped apart by now? So, and why isn't it quieting down more? Or are you just seeing a small disk that it formed? So it will be, if it's just a star, it will be behaving quite differently later on. It may be that a year from now, if it keeps on bursting and doing things, the idea of the star may go away. It may be that people say, okay, well, a single star probably couldn't do this, so what is going on?
What if it were a black hole eating another black hole? Would there be photon energy released like this strange spiky image?
That's a tough question. If they were two just pure black holes, probably not. But black holes can contain material around them that has magnetic fields and has energy. And then, yes, you can get things. So that's something that people have talked about. I think people don't really have good models, and maybe they'll develop them. It's not only what is the black hole, but what is the black hole carrying with it when it combines with the other black hole, and how do these things interact is a problem. It's a very difficult problem, and one that is still not well solved, but this observation has made people think about it again.
Right.
So when you start talking about, you know, black holes and white holes and evaporation of black holes, you're getting into areas of physics that we don't really understand very well yet, because it's probably going to take combining quantum mechanics and general relativity to really get to the heart of the matter. And that's something no one's been able to do yet.
It's amazing, isn't it, George,
sure,
that
is.
Our universe continues to shock.
And shock. And
yeah.
Shock
and yeah. Shock. And what they're going to do now is they're going to use both ground-based and space-based telescopes, such as Hubble, to see if the galaxy's core changes brightness. And then they've also submitted two papers to the journal Science, and I think they're expecting that their papers would be published maybe as early as June 2011, because this is such a remarkable phenomena. And he said to go ahead and check back with him to see if they have any new insights about what this remarkable object could be. And in the process of doing research about these GRBs to interview Dr. Fruchter, I learned something about the brightest GRB ever seen on record, much brighter than the one this March. But it's so interesting that this one was discovered, this new one, March 28, 2011, and on March 20th, 2008, almost exactly 3 years ago, at 2:12 a.m. in the morning on the East Coast, the Swift telescope sent a detection of an explosion that was so powerful that its afterglow could be seen for a while by the naked human eye. And yet the distance of this explosion was 7.5 billion light years from Earth. And George, that's halfway across the entire universe, but so powerful that it was that bright that for a little bit, a human eye could have seen that light from 7.5 billion light years away. And scientists at NASA Goddard in Maryland said, this was a quote, "Even by the standards of gamma ray bursts, this was a whopper. It blows away every gamma ray burst that we have seen so far. No other known object or type of explosion could be seen by the naked eye at such an immense distance as that GRB on March 20th, 2008, halfway across the universe. And no one knows what cosmic object exploded." I love these mysteries. I love this always surprising universe. And you ask me at the top about this FBI report.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what was interesting is that now it's 2011 and that the FBI, for some unknown reason, is now in its vault sort of let surfacing documents without any historic context. They're just like floating up in the surface of a pond, and places like the Mail Online and the Sun are grabbing some of these documents without having any understanding of the context of them. And this headline, "Mass Cow Sacrifices by Aliens Sent White House into Panic, FBI Records Reveal," and the year that they're using for the panic was 1979. Animal mutilations had been reported publicly around the world in the late 1960s. So the White House was not panicking in 1979. The FBI document is going into some of the cases, and in 1979, I know when I started in the fall of 79 to do what became A Strange Harvest, that the figure that law enforcement was using about their estimates based on files per county sheriff's office in every state in the United States, every province in Canada, Central America, South America, Mexico, Europe, they use the word probably 10,000 mutilations that fall into the category of being bloodless and no tracks, and where eyewitnesses have seen beams of light come from disks in the sky, either picking up animals or dropping them to the ground.
10,000?
10,000. That was in 79. And there have been thousands and thousands and thousands over the last 30 years since then. And here is a very interesting personal insight related to this FBI document, going all the way back again to the fall of 79 when I started on my documentary for the CBS station in Denver called A Strange Harvest. And one of the people that I talked to back then was Jim Mars, who you all know and has been the multiple book author. And Jim had gone to a conference in Albuquerque that fall in which then U.S. Senator Harrison Schmitt from New Mexico, who is referenced in this FBI document, and a whole bunch of people in law enforcement who were investigating animal mutilations, they had this big meeting. And Jim told me that at this conference that somebody handed him a 35-millimeter color slide. And it was a rancher, I believe, and they said that they had taken the photograph of their animal that was mutilated, and a blue light was coming from the body straight up into the sky.
Oh, my gosh. Great stuff. Linda, we'll talk a little bit more about that in next hour, final hour, Conversations with Linda. Let your fingers do the dialing right to your phone. We'll be right back.